Hello and welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast, where today I am thrilled to be joined by special guest Peter Docker. Now, you might know Peter from his book Leading from the Jump Seat or his work with Simon Sinek on Find Your Why. Peter has a long, impressive history of leadership positions, and now he is working his way around the world to talk about leadership from his own perspective.
When we start talking about love and fear, it's very easy for people to start thinking, oh, well, this is all a bit touchy-feely, isn't it? No, it's not. When you really get down to it, everything that's deeply important to us, everything is driven by either love or fear. It's what makes us human. And, you know, fear is triggered when we sense our life, our livelihood, our status or reputation is on the line.
Today, I am excited to dig into leadership with Peter. We're going to talk about love and fear, ego, courage, and the everyday choices that leaders make within the systems that are made for us. Leadership isn't just about getting results. It's about the impact that we have on the people around us, the cultures that we create, and the legacy that we build. So let's jump in. Welcome to the Beautiful Business Podcast from The Wow Company. If you're growing a UK business with a team of 8 to 80 people, you're in the right place. Every fortnight, we share honest conversations with brilliant business minds, exploring the realities of leadership, the challenges that come with growth, and the practical ideas that make a real difference. From purpose to profit, people to process, this is your space for fresh thinking and down-to-earth inspiration. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here today. Welcome.
Thank you. My absolute pleasure.
Before we get into it, like into the good stuff, I always like to just find out a little bit more about who I'm speaking to, right? Because online, there's a whole footprint of all of your wonderful achievements work-wise. And sometimes I think we forget to talk about like us as a human. So is there something that you can share with us that we wouldn't know about you already from the internet?
One, I love running up mountains.
Let's start there, shall we? Well,
I have to say it's a little more aspirational these days than it used to be. But I love running generally, but the freedom, the connection to the environment. And I like to say I'll run up mountains responsibly, meaning I always have a backpack with all my survival stuff. I was trained as a survival instructor when I was in the Air Force. So because the last thing I want to do is to get into a situation where I have to rely on people to come and get me. So always, if you like, safety first. The view you can see from the top. And that's a metaphor for life as well. And it's something I pick up on in my book, actually, Leading from the Jump Seat, this metaphor of running up a mountain. You know, often we can be at the bottom of the mountain looking up, thinking, my, that looks tough, but I'll give them a best shot. But actually, I say, if you're going to run up a mountain, start at the top. And what I mean by that, Chloe, is in my head, I'm thinking of Snowdon now in Wales, and I can visualize what it feels like at the top of that mountain, the smell of the air, the horizon you can see when there's no cloud, the energy that comes from the environment around you. And in my mind's eye, from the top of that mountain, I can kind of look down the path and say, yeah, I overcame all of those obstacles.
Yeah.
And that's very much a metaphor for leading oneself and leading others too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we start with that image as if we've overcome everything to get to that summit, then we get pulled up that mountain.
Yeah.
Whereas if we start at the bottom and think, oh, that looks tough, mm-hmm. there's a very good chance that you won't get there. And I can honestly say every mountain that I've run up or decided to have a go at, I've always got to the top.
Amazing. Have you conquered Snowdon?
I've run up Snowdon more times than I can remember. Years ago, I did the three peaks of Ben Nevis, Scarfell, and Snowdon. I just did it individually. I had a safety guy I served with while I was in the Air Force years ago. and I ran up all three in less than 7 hours, I think, plus the driving time.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was a little bit younger than I am now, but...
I tell you what, though, I'm not going to lie, Peter. If I was climbing one of those mountains and you came running past me, I think you'd annoy me quite a bit, if I'm honest.
I ran up one dressed as a chicken on one stage, but there we go. That's another story.
I am also intrigued by what your second thing was going to be.
31st of August, 1997.
Okay.
I think it was about 1:30 in the morning, and I received a phone call. At the time, I was an officer in the Royal Air Force. And the phone call was from the Operations Centre, the Ministry of Defence in London. A bunker there that is always ready for anything. And it was the duty officer. And he identified who I was on the phone. He said, Princess Diana has been killed in Paris. I see that you are the duty officer. You are the officer responsible for the operation to get the body back. Permission to activate. So... yeah, I was the one who got the phone call.
My goodness.
Yeah, initiate the operation to bring Princess Diana back after she'd been killed. And at the time, I was responsible for many other things as well, but I wrote all the plans for that sort of thing because, you know, the military have plans for everything. So, yeah, suffice to say, I couldn't really go to sleep. Well, actually, no, I did go back to sleep because I'd written the plan, and lots of people that I knew had all the skills and capability were spinning up into action to take that plan and run with it.
What a position to be in. I'm speechless just hearing that. I can only imagine. Like, what runs through your head in that moment?
Yeah, I mean, it was all very military, you know. It was the guys who do it, sir. you are the officer whose name is attached to this operation order. Permission to activate, and I just had to say it. Permission granted.
Yeah.
Crack on, and then everything whirls into action.
Probably not what you were expecting, was it?
No, but my goodness, we've gone from running up mountains to being first point of call to get Princess Diana's body back. That is quite a variety there.
It is, isn't it? And there's been everything in between as well.
No, thank you. Honestly, thank you for sharing that. Let's talk about your background now, your work background, which I guess we've kind of touched upon there, the military stuff. But can you tell us, for anybody that maybe doesn't know you or doesn't know your history, and I know that there's a lot to cover, but could you give us kind of a brief overview? How did you end up to where you are today?
So I joined the Air Force when I was about 20 years old as a pilot. And I spent 25 years in the Air Force. So during that time, I did a lot of things. At 24, I was the pilot to Prime Minister, flying around the world, which was an interesting thing to do at 24, and great privilege. I've led people in combat. I've run $20 billion programs. Procurement programs, been a negotiator with the Russians years ago and with the US government on behalf of the UK government. And I rose to a pretty senior rank, but after 25 years, I thought there's more I could do. So I left the Air Force. I joined a consultancy, fantastic consultancy that had nothing to do with the military or flying, but everything to do with people. And we used to work in very high risk industries like oil and gas, mining, construction, where people would typically get killed or injured. And what we did was bring a way of leading that ensured that everybody went home safe at the end of the day to their families. And so I helped build that business in the Middle East, Africa, and Europe for a few years. But then I thought, oh, there's more I could do. So I left. And actually, I spent about 18 months writing down everything that I'd learned about people and leadership. And during that time, I came across a fellow called Simon Sinek, who some people may have heard of. Mm-hmm. He did a TED talk called Start With Why. And he wrote a book by the same name. And it inspired me. I reached out to him. Long story short, I ended up working with Simon for about 8 or 9 years. I was what was known as one of the first igniters And I had the joy of going around so many countries around the world, taking this message of starting with why. And I co-wrote with Simon Find Your Why,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is in about 26 languages these days. But after about 8 years, I thought there's more I can do. So I stepped away from Simon and I wrote a book called Leading from the Jump Seat, How to Create Extraordinary Opportunities by Handing Out Control. And ever since then, that was about 4 years ago, ever since then, I've been taking that message around the world, working with some incredible companies across every industry you can imagine.
I mean, what a history there is. Do you know what baffles me is that you said at 24 you were flying the Prime Minister around. And I just think, what a responsibility to be and it's such a young age. At 24, like, I mean, as I'm in my 30s now, I look at my 20s and go, oh, I was still a baby. Surely I was. Have you ever experienced imposter syndrome by any chance? Like, or are you just superhuman?
Yeah, hugely so. But, you know, the way I relate to imposter syndrome, it can be a negative thing, but these days I look upon it as a positive thing. And here's the reason. First of all, if you're never doing anything where you feel that little bit of imposter syndrome, there's a good chance that you're not pushing yourself as far as you could. You're living inside your comfort zone. And that's the big thing for me. And a lot of the times, a lot of the roles I had, I felt completely out of my depth. And fear can creep in around that. But if you are absolutely committed to what it is you're doing and you believe in what you're doing, then that can help you overcome that fear. I think that's what I've learned over the years. 24, flying the Prime Minister, I was barely out of shorts, you know, always surrounded by extraordinary people that I've learned from, who lifted me up to be more than I could possibly imagine.
Okay, so something that I'd love to kind of do a bit of a deep dive into with you is some of your teachings around love in leadership being the antidote to fear. So before we really get into that, can you just explain what that is, what you mean by that?
There's a lot talked in the world around leadership, which really points to, you know, you've got to be a better leader. It's not like I haven't met anybody actually who has a role that involves leadership who gets up one morning and says, you know, I'm going to be a rubbish leader today. That's not the case. But what's really interesting is the impact that conditions can have. So you can take someone who is seen as an extraordinary leader, but put them into different conditions, and that all very, very quickly fades away. And they're perceived as a very poor leader. So I focus very much on the conditions people are in.
Uh-huh.
And some of those conditions we have no control over whatsoever. So, for example, in 2003, I found myself leading 200 people during the second Gulf War, the Iraq War. And the conditions then were that there was huge political unrest around whether we should be doing anything. This was going into Iraq and with the US and Australia and other coalition partners to unseat Saddam Hussein. And there were demonstrations all over the world against that proposed action. And there I was in the middle of the Saudi Arabian desert with 200 people who had similar concerns and fears. And they're looking towards me for leadership. And, you know, it's very, very tough when you're asking people to put their lives on the line when you're not clear as to the reasons that you're doing it. And there are so many conditions there of which I had no control. Yeah, I had no control of the politics. I had no control of the fact that when you join the Air Force or any military service, you don't say, yes, I promise to do my duty, except see footnotes 1 through 10. You know, it doesn't work like that. And I knew that unless I pulled everybody together, then fear would take over. And that's when you lose people. And we flew very large aircraft, but they were air refueling tankers. So our job was to refuel fighter jets around about 20,000 feet. You put hoses out the wings and the fighter jets come along and connect and you transfer fuel. And we're totally unarmed, totally undefended. And we flew around in circles and we're pretty big. So you tend to get shot at, which got a bit irritating. But I knew that before we did anything, I needed to pull my people together because fear was rife, rumors, chit-chat, gossip, and it was a distraction.
Mm.
And so before operation started, I gathered everybody to have a photograph taken because that's what you do in the military before things start. And immediately afterwards, I knew I had to say something. So I gathered all my people around me in a like a donut. I was in the middle of the donut, if you like. And I turned to all my engineers, the technicians, whose job it was to keep these 40-year-old aeroplanes running. We didn't have enough spares or supplies, but had to keep them running. I turned to them, I said, look, your job is to ensure these aircraft, each of these aircraft, are ready to fly and serves also as the pilots, the aircrew can fly them. I then turned to the aircrew and I said to the pilots, I said, look, your job is to fly every mission that we're given and refuel every fighter jet that comes up for gas. Because unless we refuel those fighter jets, the British, American, Australian troops on the ground won't get their air cover. And if they don't get their air cover, they're going to die. And in that moment, everything changed. The noise disappeared. I talk about pulling the signal out of the noise. Everybody became laser focused on what our role was. The politics had nothing to do with it. It was about taking care of those people who absolutely relied on us, even though we'd never met them before. They relied on us for their lives. And, you know, we were there for about 4.5 months. We were tasked with 479 missions, and we flew 479 missions. But everybody I took out there, I took home safe to their families. So I give this example because when we start talking about love and fear, it's very easy for people to start thinking, oh, well, this is all a bit touchy-feely, isn't it? No, it's not. When you really get down to it, everything that's deeply important to us, everything is driven by either love or fear. It's what makes us human. And when we understand how fear is triggered inside of us, rather than just being an emotion, we can choose how to lead from fear and replace it with love. And, you know, fear is triggered when we sense our life, our livelihood, our status or reputation is on the line.
Okay.
Everything falls into those four buckets. Everything. And I'm sure you can think of some examples we can talk about. But when we sense one of those areas is under threat, then we will start to go into fear. And fear closes us down. It has us think about ourselves, not about anybody else.
Yeah.
But then when we can recognize that fear is kicking in, the way we transition to love is by getting connected to something that's deeply important to us and in service of others. So in the case of my extreme example, where life, livelihood, status, and reputation are all on the line for all of us, what we connected to was the love for those people who we'd never met, but depending on us to do our job. And in that little speech I gave to everybody, what I did in that moment, I created an invitation. Because you can't make someone be committed, but you can create an invitation that they can choose to accept. And my people chose to accept that invitation. Remember John, who was a big guy, one of the aircraft engineers, maintenance engineers, shaved head, tattoos, you know. You would want to meet him on a dark night down a dark alley, you know, but actually it was the most wonderful human being. And I saw him one day in the Saudi Arabian desert where we were based, almost in tears because he couldn't fix something on the aeroplane he was working on. He didn't want to be the one to let the team down. You know, you can't buy that sort of discretionary effort. And that comes from a place of love for something. You can't have creativity, you cannot have innovation in a context of fear. So this is what I mean when we're talking about conditions. You know, the conditions we create in business, many of those we have no control over whatsoever. What we do have control over is the conditions we set for ourselves and for the people who are looking towards us for leadership and the choices over love and fear.
Since we first spoke and you talked about these, you know, love and fear sort of driving everything for us, I've really tried hard to think of something that isn't driven by either of those. And like, you're absolutely right. You know, it all stems back from something that, you know, you're either fearful of losing or that you just, yeah, that you just love and, you know, want to do well with and want to help others with. And I really like that concept of sort of the fear becoming a more selfish driver, and then you've got like kind of love being that open, and you know, you're offering that out to the world, the people, whatever it is that's in front of you.
This is not about sort of getting rid of fear or saying I'm not afraid of anything.
Yeah.
Well, not afraid of anything, then you haven't loved anything, have you? It's about recognizing that very basic human reaction, fear and love. When we recognize it, we can do something about it.
I was just going to go back to that speech to those hundreds of people stood around you and like, you know, really just like you said, drowning out the noise and bringing it back to the job at hand and actually the value and the weight of what it was that they could bring to this situation. So did you have to do any kind of top-up speeches in that time, or was that one speech enough to drive people right the way to the end?
Good question, because what I did in that speech that I said was create the invitation. But this is not a one-shot thing. The vast majority of my time was building on that commitment. So commitment is the first practice of what we call jumpseat leadership. And it's the first practice because that's the foundation on which everything else is built. Once you've got that commitment framed and put into simple language that everyone can relate to, and they can make it personal. You know, it became personal for each and every one of my people, this commitment. It then allows you to lead with humble confidence. What I mean by that is when you're leading with humble confidence, you're absolutely confident and resolute on where you're going, that commitment. But you have the humility to engage and ask others when you just don't know the answer. And why this is so important is because when we're stepping into the unknown, when conditions are coming at us that take us by surprise, yeah, AI is a great example, we don't know the answer. We need to lead with humble confidence if we're going to figure out the solution. And that means we draw on what we call the collective genius to work out the solutions to the challenges we're facing. So my Gulf War example, you know, we didn't have a lot of equipment for diplomatic reasons. All our computers had been taken off us before we landed in Saudi Arabia, and all our mobile phones. Well, my people went and found a scrapyard, a junkyard on this huge base we were, and they built stuff. They built tables and chairs that we needed to sit on out in the desert. Some guys built, I think, 10 computers out of components they found.
Huh.
You know, you think, well, I would have never thought of any of these things.
Yeah.
But when they were inspired by that commitment they'd made, then they used their skills, their genius to help figure out how to move forward. And then the third practice is around belonging. And when we feel that we belong, we're more willing to step up and do more. When we feel that others have our backs, we are willing to do more. It's what called discretionary effort, you know. People are made accountable for the work they do, whether it's an accounting company or a manufacturing company, and it's laid out in your job description. But that's not where extraordinary lives. extraordinary lives when people are willing to put in discretionary effort, go above and beyond. And that's more likely to happen when they feel that they belong and they're a part of something and they have a role to play. So coming back to your question, how I kept this commitment alive was, first of all, making sure that every decision I took was through that filter of that commitment, and then making sure I connected with everyone as often as I could. And by connection, I mean, that would be briefings on a daily basis, meetings. It would be sitting down, perhaps with the most junior person, and checking in with them and saying, how's things at home? Have you got everything you need? What are some obstacles you're finding that I could remove for you? And this nurtures that sense of belonging and unlocks all of that discretionary effort, where individuals then start to do extraordinary things. And then collectively as a team, you create the conditions where history can be made. So that's how you reinforce it. There's one story which, you know, when we're out in Saudi Arabia, I had two people actually who got a message that one of their grandparents was getting close to passing away. We moved heaven and earth to get them back within 24 hours, to get them back to the UK. I can tell you, that ain't easy. But it's just something we did. If you'd been part of that team, Chloe, and saw the actions we took to get one of your colleagues back so as it could be with the family, how would that make you feel?
Proud, I think. Proud that I was part of something that cared.
There we go. So in that instance, your sense of belonging, that the people that you're working to, in this case me, really cares. It wasn't just something we talked about, it's something we acted on. And both those people I mentioned, after they'd been home and been with the family, they both came back even more determined to contribute even more. So reinforcing the commitment you've made through the actions that you take on a daily basis, engaging people, that collective genius to help solve the problems, and nurturing that sense of belonging to all, because of all that potential it opens up.
In your opinion, how can a leader, I guess, recognize when it's perhaps their ego driving decisions rather than like genuine care or purpose? Like, are there any warning signs that someone can look out for? Because I think sometimes potentially we can think that we're leading with love, but perhaps the driving factor is actually more fear.
The simple recognition of what triggers fear in us, knowing that and having the willingness to be sufficiently self-reflective, checking with yourself, you know, am I reacting to this out of fear because I sense my life, livelihood, status or reputation is under threat? Because once we recognize that, then we can choose to do something about it. I think the other thing as well is to have an environment where people are willing to come to you and point things out if you are not being consistent with the commitment you've made. And that's the thing about a commitment, is not about keeping it to yourself. It's about declaring that commitment in very simple terms and inviting others to hold you to account. So an example again from that Gulf War story was, in the structure we had out there, I had two officers who reported directly to me, and they were great guys and I really trusted them. And on one occasion they came to me and they said, "Boss, I think you need to take an afternoon off." And this is after we'd been out there for a good month, and we were working 7 days a week, 24 hours, but I was probably working 18 hours or more a day, just so as I could stay connected with all my people as they went off on missions, came back, all my engineers on different shifts. And they came to me and said, "Look, you're getting tired." And they were concerned that that would start to show up in the quality of the decisions that I made. And because I was totally committed to what we were there to do, that allowed me to lead with humble confidence. And in that instance, what that looked like was listening to my two trusted first lieutenants, if you like, or second commands, And I did actually take an afternoon off, which was the hardest afternoon I had throughout the whole time. So I think when you have a very clear commitment, it enables you to have different conversations. It takes it away from being personal. You know, what I mean by that is, without that commitment, if my guys had come to me and say, "Boss, you're getting tired, go have some rest," I could have taken it deeply personally. But I knew that they were saying that, they had the courage to do that, because it was in service of the commitment that we all shared. So have your trusted advisors, create the environment where they are willing to be able to step up and speak to you if they see that your actions are not consistent with the commitment that you've made, when you're acting out of fear and not love.
From everything that you talk about, it sounds like you've been surrounded by incredible people, whether it be your leaders or people that you've led. You must have experienced some poor leadership at some point in your career. Some of the things that you say are like so incredible, and what an incredible team to be surrounded by, to like you just said, just even them coming to you, you can feel the care just to say, like, you need some rest, you know, that's amazing. But I know that there's plenty of work environments out there where maybe this hasn't been set up in the right way, and there isn't that kind of safety or safe environment to be able to do that, and where people are being led by leaders that maybe aren't fully leading from a place of love, whether that be by choice or whether it just be an unconscious way of leading, I don't know. But so not everyone, my point is, not everyone's going to come at this, like, look at leadership from a place of, oh, I can use that person as, you know, a guiding light, or I can use that experience as something that I would like to create for my team. What about those people? How can we give them some sort of guidance based on maybe poor experiences of leadership that they can turn into learning opportunities to be better leaders themselves?
I think it's hugely tempting to say, oh, I don't have great leadership, that's why I'm not getting the results I'm getting. Or I'm a victim to poor leadership. Or, hey, look at that story I've just told. You're surrounded by lots of fantastic people. And the reality is, we need to take responsibility for the conditions that we create. It could have turned out very, very differently, my Gulf War story, if I hadn't have created those conditions. And I want to say, you know, back then, I wasn't fully aware, perhaps as I am now, of all the mechanics of what I chose to do instinctively, why it worked. You know, this is largely the benefit of hindsight and, you know, getting very clear on what works and what doesn't. But everyone who chooses to lead, whether that is leading ourselves as individuals or leading a team formally or informally, we have the opportunity to create the conditions. We may have come from, I'm just thinking myself, you know, when I was growing up, we had very little money. My parents had both lost their jobs. And I chose to go to university and make my way in my degree. I also chose to leave mid-degree to join the Royal Air Force. I started to set the conditions around me where I could start to thrive. I could start to lead myself. Now, there are some conditions that we just can't change. Many of the people listening or watching this might think, well, my boss is dreadful. Okay. You can't do anything about that. But what can you do to affect the conditions that you can shift? What can you do in terms of how you perceive the conditions you're in?
Okay, talk to me more about that.
So we're all interested in results that we get in business, in life, you know, and particularly in business. Results, the bottom line, is what gets measured. The results we get are driven by the actions we take. And we spend a lot of time, certainly if we're in a management role, trying to have people take certain actions to get the results that we get. But that can only take us so far. It gets really interesting when you start to look at where do actions come from? What drives actions? It's perceptions. How we perceive a situation drives us to take the actions we take that gives us the results that we get. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what we do have the opportunity to do is to shift how we perceive a situation, which will then give us access to different actions, different results. So let's give a great example. I was on a podcast not so long ago with technology IT leaders.
Okay.
And there's a lot of talk about living in a VUCA world. Have you ever come across this term, Chloe?
I haven't.
Stands for volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity.
Oh, sounds scary. Okay.
Doesn't it just?
Yeah.
Is that definite, or those words, they come from a place of level fear, do you think?
Definitely fear.
There you go. VUCA actually is a term coined in military circles to describe conditions in war. And yet it's being used in the IT world and in business to describe the conditions that people are facing.
Yeah.
So if that's what we perceive in terms of the conditions that we're facing, we are looking at a place full of fear. Let's take AI as an example. You know, there's a lot of fear in lots of businesses, from marketing to accounting to every industry you can imagine, that AI is a huge threat and people are getting very, very fearful. So what happens? People start to close down. They see the world as a place of scarcity rather than possibility. And they start to protect their own jobs or life, and it closes people down. But actually, AI is just a tool. It's how we choose to use it that will make the difference. But if we attack it from a place of fear, we'll take very, very different actions and get very, very different results. If, however, we shift our perception of AI and just see it as a tool, and how can it enhance what I'm already doing, coming from a place of love and possibility, then that will drive creativity, innovation. It will drive different actions and will give us very, very different results.
Yeah, I see that. That makes sense.
How do you see fear showing up in organizations or teams that you've...
Fear of like new business and how tight new business is at the moment and how competitive it is. And then the knock-on effects of that. So if we don't get the new business, if we don't get new clients, if we don't grow, then... could we possibly shrink? Does it mean we're going to end up losing some of our staff? Like it's a knock-on effect across businesses. So new business being one, AI, like you said, being another, which, I mean, we've done a few episodes now on the Beautiful Business Podcast around AI. And I think uncertainty in that area comes very much from the unknown. And so when we talk to people who do know things and are more well-placed to talk about it, it becomes a little bit more, you know, a little bit more palatable. And you think, oh, okay. But then, of course, I think similar to what you were saying around that noise, it's the noise that you start hearing as soon as you move away from that conversation. Lots of like, oh, but what about this? And have you heard it does this? And what's going to happen to that job? So, yeah. And then even down to things like targets within business, right? You know, hitting KPIs, hitting turnover, and competition as well. What is it, comparing yourself to how other people are doing, especially in quite a volatile time when it comes to business? You know, some people are starting to really start, go back on the path to thriving, and some people are still struggling to survive. So in this age, this digital age, where we're comparing ourselves constantly and very easily to everybody else, fear is sparked from every angle, I think.
I want to differentiate between commitment and purpose. Purpose is great in that it can align a team and point to where you're going, but also it can be quite static. Purpose only takes on extra energy when you elevate it to the level of commitment. And a commitment starts with the promise you make to yourself to follow through. That's where it starts. And it talks about what are you willing to sacrifice for in order to follow through on that commitment. And a commitment is linked to what you stand for as an individual, those things that are deeply important to you. They go deeper than values. It's your stands are things that you believe in deeply because they are connected to experiences you've had in your life. And your stands act as that constant background hum to your life that guides you even when you're stepping into the unknown. So when you turn your stands into action, they can become a commitment. So start by getting very, very clear on what is your commitment in the business that you're engaged in, and articulate that in ways that is deeply connected to you personally, and help others on your team make a personal connection to that commitment, should they choose. You know, commitment is an invitation, just as I made that invitation out in the Gulf to my people. But when you have that foundation and you keep focused on that foundation of commitment, then you can start to bring into play leading with humble confidence, as I've said before. But this is where it gets very, very practical and very real. You spoke about people not knowing about the future or uncertainty. Well, engage your people, that collective genius, because while not one person may have the answer, together you can figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot do that unless you have a clear commitment that's deeply important to you. You know, so let's take the subject of AI, for example, and let's take one industry, accountancy, for example. You know, there's lots of talk about how AI could take over accountancy. Well, there are possibilities where it could make it easier and slicker. But actually, it's the human factor which is so deeply important. Mm-hmm. So if you happen to be leading an accountancy firm, I'd encourage you to focus in on the human factor. What's your commitment through the profession you have to the people that you serve? What does that look like in professional terms? What's it look like to be that trusted advisor that elevates people, gives them confidence through the numbers, gives them confidence to step beyond in their business, to go to the next level, or to achieve their aims of, you know, ensuring that they take care of their family, whatever it happens to be? How can you serve that at the human level? The more AI comes in, the more we need to connect to what really makes us human.
I smile, Peter, because that's exactly what we do at WOW. And a lot of our conversations are around, you know, how can we bring that human element? How can we show our clients how much we care? You know, what can we do to support each other? What can we do to support them? And I think that's a big takeaway for me from today's conversation, is actually it is about the commitment, but it's also about the focus and I guess being specific around what that commitment looks like. I think something that resonated when you talked about, you know, speaking to each different area of the people that were surrounding you that day, you know, they each understood exactly what their part in that role was, like, you know, what their part to play. And I keep talking about this, about how there might have been a period of time where people were just happy to kind of get their heads down and get on and just be a cog in the wheel. Whereas actually now I think people want more purpose in what they're doing. They want to understand what they're contributing and what difference it's going to make to this bigger picture. And like I say, that's something that I took away from what you were saying, is that actually you managed to, in that speech, really give that clarity to each different person on how they can support what that final goal was, which was just to keep those people on the ground alive, right? Like, and that's so specific. It's not about the bigger picture. It's not about anything that can get confused or mixed with anything else. It's a very specific, very direct commitment.
It's very personal. And I actually, what you just said closed sparked something else in me, which around commitment. We're working with a hospital complex over in the States. They have about 13 different hospitals. And in a conversation with one of their executives one day, they said, you know, our doctors and nurses, you could not find a group of more committed people. Then we pointed out, well, yeah, they are committed, but they're committed to their profession. You need to create an invitation through the commitment that you have to this healthcare system you're running, this hospital that you're running, and give that invitation to your people where they choose to deliver their capability as doctors or nurses through your healthcare system. So, you know, if we talk other professions like accountancy, for example, people are in accountancy, they love what they do, but they are committed to that profession. We need to give them a reason to be committed to our particular practice or our particular business, the opportunity, because then we retain those people. We have them feel they belong, and that's when they'll step up and do more.
In order for you to be able to offer them that invitation, you're going to need to understand exactly what it is you would like them to commit to yourself, right? So you've got to do that piece of work before you even start that invitation to understand.
You got to figure out what it is you're committed to. It's about you first. So if as a leader of a practice or a leader of a business, you can't say above and beyond the numbers what you're committed to, the difference you're going to make in the world, and what you're willing to sacrifice, how can you turn and look at your people and expect them to sacrifice anything?
I'm keen to know, between 2021 and now, as we very quickly head into 2026, so almost 5 years later, is there anything that you would, any message that you've put across in the book that you would evolve now, or that would has changed slightly in the last 5 years? Is anything different, or has it stood the test of time?
The love and fear aspect of it has become more and more prominent through the work that we've done. What I mean by that, I was at a conference giving a keynote talk in Dubai a little while ago, and the room was full of the senior global leaders of one of the biggest companies that exists. And I asked them, I gave some context, but one of the questions I asked during my keynote was, how do you feel when you face something, a challenge in the business where you don't know the answer? And I was using a Mentimeter app, so people could reply to me anonymously. I got it on my on stage. And the responses that came back were along the lines of, I feel terrified. I can't sleep at night. I feel stressed out. I don't know what to do. I feel the pressure of people looking at me. I feel like an imposter. Now, these are people who each ran parts of the business that are bigger than most companies that you and I know about, Chloe. So if their responses were all from a place of fear, just imagine how the people who report to them feel, or how the rest of us in smaller businesses.
Absolutely.
So the love fear aspect of the book and setting conditions where people can be extraordinary, even when we don't have control of all of the conditions outside, it's reaffirmed over the last 4 years how fundamentally important that is. And every senior leader of every large business we speak to, when we talk about love and fear, where fear comes from and how you can transition from fear to a place of love, that is really starting to resonate even more than I thought or imagined 4 years ago when the book came out.
Is it more common than not that people are leading from a place of fear? For you, in your kind of experience of working with all of these amazing organizations?
They might not articulate it like that at first, but when we sit down and, you know, you're a coach, Chloe, so you start by listening. And when we sit down and listen to people, we can hear the fear coming out. You know, we can inadvertently, as leaders, send out even an email that can create fear in the moment. You know, if you're part of an organization and your boss sends you an email saying, see me in the office at night, I need to see you in the office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. What's that going to create inside of you? It's going to create fear, isn't it? So we can unintentionally cause fear in our organizations, but the impact of it can go deep and wide. So yeah, the fear love conversation is a really great one, but we don't force it on people. It's an invitation. But more often than not, when we hear the symptoms they're experiencing and we replay it back through that lens and then share with them how it could be very, very different by shifting our perception then it tends to land really, really very well indeed.
And so for anybody that's listening then, that might recognise some of the things that you've mentioned today and maybe can see that perhaps some of their sort of drivers are coming from a place of fear and they might want to move that to a place of love. What's some practical, like maybe one or two practical things that they can do to actually reframe then and change that perception? Because I mean, in practice, when I'm talking to you now, I think, yeah, that sounds great, but it's easier said than done, right? To move from one to the other. So what advice would you give to those people?
Whether we're talking about leading our own lives, being a parent, for heaven's sakes, that's one of the biggest leadership challenges that many people face, or leading a team more formally. Leadership is hard. And so first and foremost, go easy on yourself. This fear component, it's human nature. It's part of what makes us human. So don't feel bad about it, you know? It's natural. Embrace it, recognize it, and then be curious as to where that fear is coming from. And if you dig deeper, more curious, you can scratch beneath the surface and discover the love, meaning what is so deeply important to you that you keep moving forward despite the fear. If you focus on that, turn the volume up on that, get very clear about it, turn the feeling into words and focus on being able to articulate it both to yourself and others in very simple terms, that will start to build that foundation of commitment where you understand the sacrifices you're making. And the love for it will pull you forward rather than trying to evade and run away from fear.
Before we finish completely then, we ask everybody on the podcast, and I can't wait to hear your answer to this. What does beautiful business mean to you?
Success for me is the joy I feel at the end of the day. It's the joy that is reflected in the eyes of people that I've had the privilege of working with, supporting, helping to shift their perception, choosing love over fear. That's what beautiful business looks like. And I feel very privileged to be a part of it.
Oh, fantastic answer. Well, I feel privileged to have had this conversation with you today. So thank you so much for joining us on the Beautiful Business Podcast. And best of luck for your upcoming adventures.
You're most welcome, Claire. Great speaking with you.
Thank you for listening to the Beautiful Business Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, then please remember to subscribe and leave us a review. For more advice and practical tips on what it's really like to build a beautiful business, visit our content hub at wowco.uk/hub or check out the link in the show notes.